To UBC Arts on Air, a new program of profiles, interviews, and discussions with leading UBC faculty and students. And this afternoon I'll be talking to Daniel Heath Justice, new chair of the First Nations Studies program at UBC and a member of the Department of English. Now, by way of introduction, I should mention that Daniel's a member of the Cherokee Nation and the author of Our Fire Survives the Storm, a Cherokee Literary History, as well as an Indigenous fantasy trilogy. Daniel, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I want to start off by asking you your first impressions of Vancouver. I know you've recently arrived,
yes.
I think last May, from Toronto. Is it what you expected, or is it totally the opposite?
I didn't grow up in Canada, so I didn't have kind of a lifetime of expectation, but it has been wonderful. I thought it would be good. I have been delighted to be here. So it's, I knew it would be congenial, but I didn't expect the degree of friendliness that I found, especially in a city. I guess I got a little too used to a little more of the impersonality of Toronto. So that has been a real delight. The food culture here is amazing. I think just the niceness of people has been...
So, but is it really that different? I mean, it's Canada, Daniel. I mean, really.
Yeah. Well, there are lovely people in Toronto as well, but I do think that the urban spirit is very different. I think in Toronto, people actively avoid eye contact. That it's very much hustle and bustle, and when my partner and I were here in January to check out the location and just get a sense of whether or not this is a move that we wanted to make, he walks very slowly, and I've kind of gotten into the fast Toronto pace, and we were here for a couple of days, and all of a sudden he stopped in the middle of the sidewalk, and he turned to me and he said, "Everybody walks the same speed I do. I'm not being pushed off the sidewalk. People aren't forcing me off because they're in such a hurry." And after that, I started paying attention, and my pace started to slow down a bit, and his slowed down even more, but it's been... There is definitely a difference. There are lovely people everywhere, but I do think that there's a haste to life in Toronto that I just don't feel here.
Okay, so that's lovely kind of social description. What about culturally, and what about even more specifically in your own area of professional, academic, and personal interests? And of course, I'm thinking of the Native culture here.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about that?
Absolutely. One really significant difference for me is that there is just such a profound presence, visible presence, of Aboriginal people, particularly First Nations peoples, here in Vancouver. Not just in terms of art, not just in terms of architecture, but actually in terms of people, human beings. And there are a lot of Aboriginal people in Toronto, but I think in many ways in Toronto, Indigenous presence is rendered more invisible, whereas here First Nations and other Aboriginal peoples are very much a presence. UBC is on Musqueam territory, and that is reiterated in many, many ways, and I really like that the naming of the fact that we are on traditional, ancestral, and unceded Musqueam territory is a really an important step, and it's one... The naming of Toronto as Mississauga territory with Haudenosaunee connections, that is something that goes on there as well, but not in the same way. And I've really appreciated the visibility and the really clear protocols that are here. And there are just so many different people, and there's a lot to learn, and there are a lot of new relationships to build. And in some ways, it's a bit daunting, but it's also really exciting.
Well, it's a challenge, right?
It's absolutely a challenge, yeah.
Total challenge. And I think for yourself, I would trust, I hope, that you see it as an attraction.
Oh, that's one of the main reasons I came, absolutely.
Could you say a little bit about your sort of early education, your early life? What led you to academics and to this wonderful combination, as I understand it, between the kind of creative dimension to your life, to your work, and the more formal university academic dimension to it? teaching, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in a really small mining community in Colorado called Victor, Colorado. And when I was growing up, it was a big metropolis of 250. And now we're up to about 400, I guess. My parents still live there. I still go back pretty regularly. And I was always a really bookish child. I'm my dad's youngest child. I'm my mom's only. So I had the advantage of kind of being the center of attention in a lot of ways. But also, I didn't have a lot of friends. My siblings are all much, much older. So it was just really me and my folks. We're one of the few Native families in the area, but we shared kind of the same economic lifestyle of the people around us, which was pretty well wage labor in the mines. And you know, one mine would be there for a while and then would pick up and leave. And during the summer, there was tourist industry, so you hoped you make enough money in the summer to last the winter. And books were a refuge for me, and they were an escape. And being a bookish child with some, you know, ambiguous masculinity amongst my peers made it a place I really wanted to escape. You know, and fantasy books were where I went, because that was a place where nerds could do well.
It's interesting. Do I detect a connection between your later writing?
Oh, absolutely.
And early reading?
Absolutely. But I read voraciously in all genres and all forms, but fantasy was a particular love. And part of that was just this was in these other worlds, bookish, nerdy, geeky people could ascend to great heights and could maybe even defeat the jocks and the bullies, and it was a good place to go. But it was also, I had a lot of cultural shame. I was not interested in being Cherokee. I wasn't interested in being Native. I really saw culture as being something that happened in England, that literature was something that was brought over, that was something that sophisticated people in Oxford were responsible for, not my own people, not my own family. And so from an early age, I was also kind of distancing myself from a lot of the teachings and the wisdom and the guidance that I was getting at home and in my community.
So what happened? What was there a moment or a series of events or one or two people?
My folks were always incredibly supportive, and they were really supportive of my dreams, and I managed to get to university. We had no money, so I managed to get on scholarship, and I was at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. And it was a struggle, and a lot of it was a struggle because I was continually trying to be something that I wasn't. I was trying to be this, you know, tweed-wearing...
Pipe-smoking.
Exactly, Oxford don, when that just wasn't me. That wasn't where I was from, and I was having a hard time reconciling my own personality with this artifice that I had created. And it was when I was, I think, third year that started to really break down. I was just really, really unhappy. And I started to look homeward. And I started to just learn that, well, actually, no, we have culture, and we have literature, and we have accomplishments that rival those of anyone else. And what I had learned at home was not something to be ashamed of, but actually something that had kept me going and really reflected the strength and integrity and the pride and the accomplishments of my family and my generations of family, not just my Cherokee family, but my German Jewish family and, you know, many people, generations. That was a huge turning point for me. And then I had originally planned to go into graduate work in Gothic literature. And I had a professor who told me, when I showed him my application letter, he said, and he taught Latino lit, and he said, son, we need to talk. And he said, why don't you go into, well, actually his first question was, what can you bring to Gothic literature? And I didn't have an answer for him. I could not respond to that question because I couldn't. And he said, why don't you go into Native literature? You always say that you're interested in knowing more about your family. why don't you do that? And my first question, I'm embarrassed to say, was, you can do that? I had no idea that you could actually go into native literature, even though there were native lit courses taught in the English department. But I had avoided those like the plague. So it was a very steep learning curve. But I was really fortunate that my family was thrilled. I had really good friends who welcomed me into those conversations. I had one friend in particular who was also Cherokee, who helped kind of guide me home. And that's where it started. University was where I began a pretty long process of cultural recovery. And for some people, education is a process of cultural devastation. For me, it was a way of coming back.
So how do we jump from what you've just described to your writing a Cherokee literary history?
That started when I was a graduate student. I read a book by a Creek Cherokee scholar and novelist, Craig Womack. And his book, his critical book, was called Red on Red, Native American Literary Separatism. And it is a Creek literary history. Muscogee Creeks are neighbors of ours in Oklahoma. And it was a watershed moment. It was an unbelievable book. And what was really exciting to me was that I didn't have to just study kind of a pan-native literary tradition, but I could actually study just Cherokee literature. And that was a really stunning revelation. I don't know why it didn't occur to me before, but it wasn't until I saw his book as a model. And his book was revolutionary in the field, and it was certainly revolutionary for me and anyone in my generation who came of age at the same time. That book was transformative to the way that we understood our approach and our possibilities. So it was just a natural extension. Part of my cultural recovery was also learning more about our literature, and all of those things kind of mutually reinforced one another.
Is this the first or second or third history of Cherokee literature?
It's the second study of Cherokee literature, kind of published study. It's one that's kind of the most wide-ranging. So there was one that was published a few years before that was quite a bit more focused in scope. Mine was a bit broader. And I think there are some others that are being written now which may or may not be I don't know what they're going to approach, but they're certainly going to offer a lot more than I was able to access. I mean, I was limited in the fact that I don't speak the language, and we have a lot of literature that's in the language. So mine was necessarily focused on English. There's been a lot published since, and there's been a lot recovered that I didn't have access to. So it's one of hopefully many, many, many.
So continuing with the somewhat fantasy theme, now you wake up and you're chair of the First Nations program at UBC. What do you see as some of the challenges in that particular role?
Well, one of the big challenges is just visioning a program that has a lot of potential and possibility, but is still growing. And so how do we realize the visions that we have? And I think we have everything we need to do that. It's just a matter of bringing those pieces together. I'm really fortunate to be stepping into a program that has a lot of support. My predecessor, Link Kessler, is a man who has a lot of respect in the community, and a great deal of respect from me, because he has created a lot of goodwill for the program and established a lot of good relationships. So I'm not stepping into a program that needs fixing. I'm stepping into a program that is small but healthy. We've got amazing faculty. We've got amazing staff. Our students are stellar. So we have so much, but we're also small, and there are a lot of demands on our time. The faculty are all junior faculty, and so how we build on that and do so in a way that's really doesn't add more pressures or unnecessary pressures to a faculty that's already pretty stretched. That's a challenge, but it's also one that I'm very committed to meeting. And again, they're wonderful and they're incredibly supportive. So it's a good community to step into relationship with.
Tell me, from the student's point of view, what do you think students hope to learn from the program or aspects of the program?
There's a lot that they expect. They expect intellectual rigor, high academic standards. They expect relevance. They want to see ways in which the work that they're doing is not just theoretically significant, but significant in the lives of either their lives or in the lives of Aboriginal community members or Indigenous peoples in general. Or even if they're not working with Indigenous communities, that it makes a difference in terms of the presence and representation of Indigenous peoples in Canada and elsewhere in the world. I think relevance is a huge one, that they want to do the really theoretically savvy and challenging work, but they don't want it to be only a theoretical program. They want to know that this work makes a difference in the lived realities of human beings. And that's our commitment, but it's also our challenge to make sure that we're able to balance theory and practice in a way that's ethically responsible, intellectually rigorous, and sustainable with the resources that we have.
I understand that one of the somewhat controversial approaches in contemporary Native literary studies is known as Indigenous literary nationalism.
Yes.
What is that?
It's an umbrella term for approaches to literary studies that ground the analysis in Indigenous intellectual traditions and history and perspectives. So whereas in literary studies, deconstruction would be a critical mode, or feminist criticism or eco-criticism. There are a lot of different ways to approach literature. We say that, well, you can approach it viably with any of those perspectives, but you could also approach it from a Cherokee perspective. You know, and what would that be? Not to say that there's only one Cherokee perspective, but what would a Cherokee reading of Cherokee literature that is rooted in our history, social practice, and intellectual production, what would that look like? That's literary nationalism. It's saying that indigenous communities have a voice in the critical engagement of the literatures that come out of those communities. It's not saying that those are the only perspectives that matter. It's not saying that they're the only right ones, but it is saying that those perspectives have a place in the conversation, and in some cases actually might have a particularly important place for a sophisticated understanding of the literature.
Now, does that carry over to your own creative writing? And is it connected to, I think, what you've described as an Indigenous epic fantasy?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we are just as capable of creating really exciting, fantastical worlds as anyone else. But those worlds are going to be shaped by our perspectives and our priorities. And for me, I've always loved fantasy literature. But as I started to get older, and especially when I was starting to return home and engage my own family history, it was occurring to me that I wasn't seeing much of my family in these fantasy novels, which were almost always set in a pseudo-medieval Europe, where indigeneity was generally kind of either represented as noble savages or, you know, swarthy hordes of belligerent tribespeople. And it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, my family would have been those people if we were in these stories. So I wanted stories from our perspectives, where indigeneity wasn't something to be progressed over, but actually that rooted people in the land, in communities, and in relationship with the world that they inhabited, but also with a future, rather than kind of drifting off into the sunset or being slaughtered.
Are you working on something new at the moment in terms of the creative writing?
I am, yes. So my first series was a fantastical kind of engagement of removal policies that similar to the Cherokee Trail of Tears, but it's set in a secondary world. It's quite a bit distinctive. My new one is I've described it as a mashup between True Grit, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Wind in the Willows. So it's quite a bit darker and it's quite a bit weirder, but it takes up issues of relationship and kinship and personhood that come out of my critical work and out of the values that, you know, so many of us are engaging.
Where are you setting this new work?
This is in another secondary world. Yeah.
And is this something which I could eventually find, and forgive me for asking, online?
Oh, absolutely. Well, my first book was released as in an omnibus edition by the University of New Mexico Press, and it's available on Kindle. And I certainly hope that the next series will be available, you know, in paper and electronic forms.
I think it sounds marvelous. Do you find that the creative feeds into the academic writing?
Absolutely. And they each provide a release. So if I'm spending a lot of time on the creative, sometimes I just need to shift away from that and focus on something that I can actually go research and I can cite, and there's a concreteness to it. And then sometimes if I'm too heavily into that world, I need something to kind of get me out of that into a more creative space. They definitely work together. Our Fire Survives the Storm was written at the same time as the original trilogy. So they are very much complementary texts in some significant ways.
Let's come back for a few moments that we have left to the First Nations Studies program again. Tell me what you imagine it to be 10 years from now.
Oh, in 10 years, we're a department. And we have 15 faculty. And we have a few hundred students. And we have continuing and very strong relationships with Musqueam, which we have those relationships now, but they will get even stronger. We'll have strong relationships with other First Nations communities and the local Aboriginal communities. We will have international connections with Indigenous studies and Indigenous communities across the Pacific, throughout North America. We will be the place people go to engage with critical Indigenous studies worldwide. But we will be the leader in North America. That's my vision in 10 years.
Would this be doubling the student population, for example?
Oh,
tripling.
Yeah, why stop with double? Absolutely. I mean, but it's not just the issue of numbers, but also that those numbers are fully supported. It's not necessarily always difficult to get Indigenous students into institutions, but oftentimes when they get there, they don't necessarily have the resources they need when they're in those institutions. So we want the numbers to grow, but we also want those students to be sustained. And we want this to continue to be an even more supportive, an even more encouraging, and an even more exciting place for Indigenous students to be participants in their education and to feel like, by coming to UBC, they are able to make a really strong and significant contribution back to their communities, rather than feeling that by going to university that somehow they're pulling away. This can be a place for them to maintain those cultural ties, not lose them. And a lot of work has already been done in that regard. There's a lot of good work, particularly under our current president. And there's a rich community of advisors and instructors and students and community members who have worked really hard to make UBC a more inviting place. In 10 years, I see that expanding exponentially.
I think it's a terrific high note to pause on. And Daniel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and certainly invite listeners to tune in for future shows with imaginative, stimulating, and I hope provocative members of the Faculty of Arts. Thanks again, Daniel.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Robin.
And Juliana.
And we're doing the fill-in show again this week. We're just kind of scrambling here. There's a little bit of a confusion with scheduling and stuff. So we're just going to put you straight into a song. This is The Seeing Cake. The song is called Heart.